Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always nice to have you here. Want to thank you from all over the world and all the different syndicated stations for playing us at this time. Today, we're going to talk about a Tokyo University study that found that blueberries could treat inflammatory disorders. That's a big deal. We have a lot more on that topic, on living a longer and healthier life. And then today I have a guest in the last segment of the program. His name is Michael Kane, K-A-N-E, and he has worked for a long period of time as a school teacher in New York City. He is a member of the New York Teachers for Choice, a grassroots organization that is 100% opposed to forced vaccination of teachers. And he's been a former union delegate working on committees to improve public school conditions. And he says, stop the forced COVID vaccination of New York school teachers. All right, we'll hear what he has to say. Also today, I want to give you some very interesting insights. The entire COVID pandemic is collapsing because of so many qualified scientists and physicians and nurses coming forward to tell the truth. For example, we have a Dr. Hiko Shoning. He represents 1,000 medical doctors in Europe, principally, saying that the COVID virus is not as deadly as what we have been led to believe. The figures, statistics are wrong. The test is inaccurate, not a gold standard. And they're combining deaths from other comorbidities like diabetes and emphysema. So therefore, if you take away all that, you're not left with the pandemic. Yes, you're left with a deadly virus, but also one that is not as deadly as the flu in many cases, because the flu hits kids, children, infants. This doesn't. So for going to speak in Trafalgar Square, he was arrested. There's a 3-minute interview that a journalist did with him. See what he has to say. Then you haven't heard of Paul Weston. But this could be the COVID lie that'll bring down the British government. He is methodical, and his sources I checked personally yesterday, they're all accurate. Everyone has been misreading the statistics. He gets it right, and a journalist questioning a member of parliament gets it right, and the member of parliament has no response to her. You'll see what I'm talking about. Then, on September 27th, 1966, Martin Luther King was interviewed in a short discussion, 4 minutes, by Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes. And he said, the right is the language of the unheard, but he is opposed to rioting and violence. And he explains why. And at a time when we need voices of wise men and women coming forward, people have been a part of movements for decades and giving us a perspective, an honest perspective of how much progress we've made, which is phenomenal. And yet today you wouldn't know that if you heard some of the voices, the more radicalized and anarchistic voices, that we've made no progress, that we have to tear down and burn down the entire system and remake it somehow. That's just insane. And too many people are appalled by what they're seeing because they see how that is a prescription for conflict that we don't need. So we're going to have some voices on a reason that will look at the problems we have honestly, show you solutions to those problems without tearing the fabric of what we've woven together through conciliation and forgiveness and progressive ideals. And we've done a lot. And there are a lot of good people in this country. So we're going to acknowledge them. And finally, time permitting, 5 young men repeatedly disturb an elderly veteran's meal. Well, what's that about? Not what you think. Because for every meal that we see someone screaming in your face and throwing chairs and your table upside down and you've just been sitting there having a meal, they know nothing about you. Nothing at all. Yet they're willing to condemn you. And so then we don't see the other side of the story. Today, time permitting, you will. And you can go to prn.fm and watch these videos in real time if you have that capacity. And if you don't, then you can hear it. It's still moving. I'll play about 5 minutes of it. So we have a really packed show for you today. We always start with the latest on health and healing. And let me, I got a person who asked me a question on the street when I was at the farmer's market the other day. And the person's a physician and came over to me and said, you're Gary Noyce. Yeah, he says, what do you got against saving people's lives? I said, I do save people's lives, a lot of them. He says, no, you're anti-vaccine. I said, says who? Show me the proof of that. And you're against medicine. I said, to the contrary. I said, let me explain this. I want to explain it for everyone in this audience. I am 100% in support of vaccines. If, and here's caveat emptor, consumer beware, if they can be proven safe and effective based upon classical double-blind placebo-controlled study where the placebo is a saline saltwater solution, and what they've been using up to this point is other vaccines as the placebo, which is a fraudulent study, or they've been using aluminum as an adjuvant, which itself is neurotoxic and cause all kinds of immunological problems. So there is no study that I can find that's a true placebo-controlled study. Also, if you're going to do a proper study, you have to follow it for at least 3 to 5 years because many symptoms only manifest years later. But the vaccine court says you have to file your case with the Justice Department, and they're not friendly, within 90 days. But only a small percentage of vaccines' adverse effects will come within that 90 days. So it's a rigged system. So if you have that everyone who has a vaccine-injured child will be compensated, and if you have that there is proof, independent proof, not the makers of the vaccine, but an independent scientific review board that reviews the studies and says this is safe and effective, I would support it. Same way with drugs. I've been promoting 4 different medications, including hydroxychloroquine, that's been used for 65 years safely, because the peer-reviewed scientific literature on PubMed supports it, plus doctors' statements support it, plus clinical studies support it, plus the top epidemiologist in America, MD, PhD from Yale, and who is also sits on the board, review board of peer-reviewed literature, has published 300 articles, says it is the most effective drug he has ever seen in his life for treating a condition. And it's safe. And there's studies. Well, then I support that. I'm not telling people to take alternative doctors' therapies. In fact, I've not even had a single alternative doctor give their therapies, yet I know they work because that's the basis of this program. But we give that every day and have for 53 years. So instead, I wanted to show you what within orthodox medicine works. I'm a big supporter of any kind of emergency medicine, anything such as you get your eye cut or you need retinal surgery to reattach your retina if it's detached, or you need stem cell therapy if you have a particular type of cancer, or you need any kind of emergency medicine if you had a heart attack or stroke, if you've had something burned. We're the best in the world of helping with emergency medicine. Here's the problem, and I fully support that. That represents about 12% of all medicine, which means 88% of medicine is chronic care, and that fails miserably. And who says it fails miserably? They do, the doctors and the organizations. How do we know? Because for 5 years, a team of us, all experienced researchers and clinicians, including 4 MDs and myself, a PhD, we did the work only using their statistics. And using their statistics, we came that it was the number one cause of death. Now, the AMA has officially said it's the third leading cause of death. We wrote to the chairman of the board of the AMA and showed him our statistics and said, your statistics are not complete. You did not include infections, including bed sores, gangrene that people die from. In 1 year, 88,000. Malnutrition in 1 year, 50,000 people died of malnutrition in hospitals that they got from being in the hospital. And some other conditions that they didn't put up on their list. We did. Ours is a more comprehensive review. Mind you, these are only people dying in a hospital, but not at home. So imagine each year, more or less, depending upon the, from 500,000 to nearly a million people die because of iatrogenic or medical-based disease. That is far worse by magnitudes than the COVID-19 virus. And we don't shut down a single thing or do anything because of these people dying. Now, we should have proper care, but we don't. I'm for universal health care, and I've laid it out how everybody who chose could be covered for all conditions for their entire life, and it would save us $2 trillion a year. And I laid it out and sent it to members of Congress. Not a single thing was done. We published it. Nothing was done about it. How to save the environment. These are things that we give people the calls to action. Here's the proof of what we could do if we planted a billion trees a year, which we could easily do. But we haven't done a single thing. So we're in the mess we are today. So medicine hasn't done anything to stop using things like synthetic hormone replacement therapy. So yes, I challenge it because what they're doing is causing lives. But I also did 44 clinical studies. I don't know of anyone else in America that's done 44 health clinical studies and published in peer-reviewed journals and presented my information at scientific conferences throughout the world. But they won't use how to reverse or prevent menopause naturally. But 500 women in this audience were in this study for a year, meeting every week, and they did it. So the truth is not within the orthodox model. Therefore, you can do two things. You can promote an alternative model that is based upon quality science coming from PubMed and peer review, or you can promote only the orthodox pharmaceutical approach, which is not in PubMed, which is based upon the power of politics and propaganda. So that is my position. So I'll give you an example of this. Tokyo University of Science. Now, we know that there are various plants and their products, and they're known to contain what is called bioactive, B-I-O-A-C-T-I-V, bioactive, ingredients that can alleviate human diseases. Now, these phyto compounds often contain restorative biological properties, such as anti-cancerous, antioxidant, anti-inflammatory effects. Thus, understanding how they interact with the body can lead to potential treatments using what we call functional foods against most of the major immune disorders. And that's exactly what they found. It was a several years study, and they identified functional foods and their positive impact on the body. Tremendous success. This was published in the FASEB journal. That's a scientific journal. And they said that it was the polyphenolic compound called stilbenzene, PSB. It is not spelled as it sounds. It's with a PT. But what you have to know is this nutrient is in blueberries in a large amount, and it turns off chronic diseases, including inflammatory bowel disease, which is very common today. So does aloe vera, by the way, and curcumin. So if you use blueberries and curcumin and aloe vera, put it all in a drink, you would go a long way to helping yourself. Also, resveratrol does good work on turning off pro-inflammatory cytokines in the body. So resveratrol is also a polyphenol, and it's immunomodulatory. It is strongly anti-inflammatory, and it's good against colitis, spastic colon, diverticulitis, all your itis is in your intestine. Something that simple. So, by the way, there are two types of immune cells. They're what is called the dendritic cells, or the DCs, and the T cells. They're also involved at the onset of immune response. For example, your DC cells produce inflammatory cytokines and activate T cells to initiate a defense response. And this process together form a complex pathway that results in what is called a hyperimmune response. Thus, to find an effective compound that can suppress the immune system, it was crucial to test it on this popular immune cells. And that's how they found how powerful blueberries were in this. So you want some inflammation, because inflammation tells you that you have an injury. But you don't want that inflammation to go from mild to full cytokine storm, because then you get swelling and pain and retention of fluid. So, one more reason to have your berries every day. From the HSC University in Russia comes an interesting study published in the journal Mindfulness. Loving kindness meditation will make you happier than compassion meditation. And loving kindness meditations turn out to be more effective when it comes to increasing happiness. But in contrast with previous studies, compassion meditation also did not result in a growth of negative emotions. They both are good. But you see, with compassion, you're feeling, in effect, you're feeling the pain, or you're feeling some form of emotion towards that which is, you consider unjust, shaming someone that did not deserve to be shamed, or a bullying, whatever it is that is a grievance. In your meditation, you can feel compassion for the sufferer. Whereas loving kindness is, you actually extend the love, you extend your kindness, you become proactive. One is passive, well, I'm sorry for your suffering. Another is, how can I help you with your suffering? One is, it's terrible what they're doing to you. And the other is, we can change this if we work together. So I think loving kindness meditation is very important, especially with the world we live in today, where a lot of people could use some love and kindness and some help. Also, when we isolate children and we don't allow them to play with other children, don't get outside, this kind of social isolation during childhood, according to Mount Sinai School of Medicine, it can adversely affect specific brain circuitry. It can damage it. So loneliness is recognized as a serious threat to mental health. Even as our world becomes increasingly connected over digital platforms, young people in our society are feeling a growing sense of isolation. In the COVID-19 pandemic, which forced many countries to implement social distancing and school closures, magnifies the need for understanding the mental health consequences of social isolation and loneliness. And while research has shown that social isolation during childhood, in particular, is detrimental to adult brain function and behavior across mammalian species, the underlying neural circuit mechanisms have remained poorly understood. Now, a team at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai has identified specific subpopulations of brain cells in the prefrontal cortex. That's a key part of your brain that regulates social behavior that are required for normal sociability. And so if we don't have this sociability and socializing as young people, and if we stay secluded and spend too much time on our computers, and then in adulthood, we can be profoundly vulnerable to the consequences. This was published in Nature Neuroscience. So socialize, especially children, and don't hyper guard them. Don't be the helicopter mother or father that hovers over your children so they can never make a mistake and you're always there to defend them and to protect them and keep them isolated. People have to see the world for what it is. I remember once, not long ago, just 2 years ago, I was premiering a film at the Huntington Arts Cinema, and there's a scene in it that's very graphic. It's about how food gets to the table, and it shows the abuse in factory farming and slaughterhouses. Now, mind you, these are all sentient beings, and as someone who is, I was just doing some counting yesterday, and I believe it's over 5,000 animals I've rescued and got back to health, physical and emotional health, and found a loving home for life for. I can tell you that these animals are extremely intelligent, and they really respond to love. And once you give them love, wherever you're at, they'll go there and lay on the ground right beside you and put their head in your lap and, you know, just look up at you. And of course, your heart melts because there's these beautiful eyes looking at you and they just want to be loved. How could you accept that that creature is going to be, in effect, tortured and abused so you can have your steak? So while this was going on, I was outside in the lobby, and because it was packed house, I didn't want to take anyone's seat. And this teenager comes out, and I said, and he was just standing there, I said, "What's wrong with the movie? Too graphic." "Which part?" About the animals, the calves. "I should eat veal." He said, "Yeah." "Eat chicken?" "Yeah." "Well, now you know where it comes from. Are you still going to eat it, knowing that something has to suffer and die when you didn't need it at all?" I don't know how to handle this. I've never been exposed to this. And then the mother comes out and says, "You need to see this." And takes the kid, walks him back in. And at the end, the mother was appreciative, said, "This is one of the very painful lessons that someone has to learn, and I'm sorry that I never thought about showing my child where food comes from." I said, "Well, you know something better? Take some time and go up online and download where your farmers are living and what they're doing and how hard they work and how dedicated they are and how humble they are, how gracious they are, and we don't even think about them. Without that farmer working 7 days a week, because if you own a farm or a ranch, you got to be on call all the time. And they're some of the hardest working people in the world. They get the least appreciation." So the person said they would. So again, it's a matter of using the opportunity to see life for what it is, even when what we're seeing can embarrass us or offend us or cause an inner outrage. I'd rather know the truth and then look for how I could respond to it in an appropriate and peaceful manner than not to know the truth because it was more than my being can handle. That's the latest on Health and Healing. We're 23 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back from the break, we're going to go to a clip. Now, here's the clip. And you can watch these by going to prn.fm. And by the way, our number to call in if you want to go to our archives, download any show, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. By the way, tomorrow night's show is going to be a really powerful show because one of the brightest scientists in the world, one of the most academically achieved, Professor Cahill, will be sharing insights on what we should know about COVID that we were not told. But what we're going to do now, we're going to play you a piece from Paul Weston. And he's explaining in detail. It's not a long clip, but it's very important you understand this, that we have been given the wrong information worldwide on statistics about false positives because virtually all the studies come in now show that the tests you're taking are have high degrees of false positive or false negative. There's no gold standard test. I've been saying this from day one because I knew Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize. I filmed him a couple times. And he said this test should never be used to determine how active a virus is in a person's body. It's just a magnification test. In any case, that's what they're using. It's not the test they should be using, but they're making public policy based on false information. Back with that. And you haven't heard this before. This is the first time you hear this information. Please stay tuned.
Hello, I'm Paul Weston, and this video is about false positive COVID infection test results, which sounds pretty tame, but in reality is of crucial importance because they reduce the true number of positive COVID infection results by somewhere between 90 to 100%. In other words, pretty much all of them. And the reason for this is because the inbuilt false positive error count in COVID testing, which is huge, is not being subtracted from the raw number of tests returning an apparent positive infection label. By this, and I'll just get this out of the way quickly, I mean that the total number of tests returning a COVID positive result are actually made up of a number of true positives and a number of false positives. And in order to establish the scientific accuracy of the overall test results, the false positives must be subtracted from the overall figure, which leaves a new, much, much lower figure of true positives. And if this was done today, the number of true positive test results are reduced by 90 to 100%. I know it sounds hard to believe, but it's very much the case, backed up by Professor Carl Hennigan of Oxford University's Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine, and I'll leave a link to that below. And I think we can agree this is pretty important, considering our country is being locked down only because of the alleged positive COVID test results and nothing else. It's not deaths, it's not case fatality rates, it's not the overwhelming of the NHS. It's just dishonestly presented and deliberately distorted positive test results. Now, all testing for a virus or a pregnancy or a cancer, you name it, has a built-in error percentage. And this is because the process of testing is subject to human error, to coding error, to machine error, to freezers at the wrong temperature, the age and deterioration of the material being tested, etc., etc. And most of these error percentages are known. But as of today's date, the error rate for potential false positives in COVID testing is not known. And one government document suggests that the lowest error rate for false positives is 0.8%, with a higher rate of 4.3%, so a mean average rate of 2.3%. And I'll use the average 2.3% in the following calculations. But I would point out that even if the lowest 0.8% is used, it still demolishes the government lies about large and rising infection figures. Okay, so the government has carried out almost 20 million tests to date. See the yellow, see the figure highlighted in yellow, which have returned 423,000 positive results, again highlighted in yellow. These are then presented to us as the genuine number of positive infection cases in order to terrify us. And this is an absolute scandal. It's a criminal act, in fact, because they haven't been adjusted for the 2.3% false positive error count. And I know it sounds small, but it's anything but, because it's magnified massively, as the 2.3% applies not to the 423,000 results figure, but to the 20 million people tested figure. An inbuilt error percentage only applies to the total number of people tested, not to the much lower test result figure itself. And this is crucially important for obvious reasons. 2.3% of 20 million is 460,000. That's 460,000 false positives, a figure far higher than the 423,000 unadjusted overall positives, which suggests there are no true positives at all in terms of statistical relevance. So why is the government lying to us, and why are they doing what they're doing? One answer is criminal stupidity. I've seen several ministers, including Hancock, interviewed by Julia Hartley Brewer, who asked them about the false positive figures issue, and they seem to think that if 10,000 tests returned 110 positives and the false positive error percentage was 1%, then the said 1% applies to the 110 positive results, therefore reducing the number to 109, a matter of little importance in the overall scheme of things. But they're wrong. It applies to the 10,000 tested, and 1% of 10,000 is 100, meaning the true positive number is only 10, not 109. This is hugely important, obviously, and to get it wrong because of crass stupidity or deliberate design is now a matter for government inquiries and the criminal courts. And I'm quite serious about this. This is a scandal, the scandal of the century, and it's more than capable of bringing this government down. The mainstream media don't want to acknowledge this or talk about it, but they'll be forced to do so shortly. And then this criminal government is toast. Julia Hartley Brewer of Talk Radio is the only mainstream media journalist talking about this, God bless her. So this video will end with clips of her showing government ministers to be utterly clueless or malevolent liars, take your pick. Actually, quite apart from their scientific ignorance, the overwhelming impression they all give is of loathsome smarminess and arrogance. And what's with the Tony Blair glottal stop they seem to have picked up? Anyway, before the clip start, I will just say please study the links about false positive research I put underneath this video. I was going to include some of it in this video, but it would have made it far too long. Also, please spread this video, download it and spread it far and wide because it is sure to be memory-holed. And do please subscribe to my channel. Anyway, here's Julia exposing the ministers. No, one last thing. Julia, if you see this video, perhaps you might ask Health Secretary Hancock next time you interview him precisely what percentage figure the government is using to allow for the false positive error count and whether the numbers produced by this percentage figure are being subtracted from the overall positive test figures. If you do and you keep at him, you'll finish his career there and then. But you do need to fully understand the science on this before you use that knowledge to skewer him. Anyway, here's Julia.
You say the number of people in hospital has doubled. The number of people who've tested positive for COVID who are in hospital has doubled. One of the great sort of spikes we've been seeing is in Bolton. How many patients are currently in hospital with coronavirus in Bolton?
I haven't seen the figure,
it's
but
two.
I have. No, that's not true.
It's so true. That's what the official figures state.
No, well, that's not true. It's much higher than that. I've seen the shape of the curve. I don't know the exact
shape
figure.
Of the curve. Okay, let's talk about shapes of curves because we know that coronavirus cases are going up. But again, lots of people, including Carl Hennigan, professor of evidence-based medicine at Oxford University, who has helped to influence some changes in government policy recently, has pointed out these aren't cases of coronavirus. These are people who've tested positive for the test. What is the false positive rate on the testing that we're doing in the community?
Under 1%.
It's under 1%.
Yes.
Even around under 1%, do you know the exact rate?
Under 1% means that for all the positive cases, the likelihood of one being a false positive is very small.
Is there any scrutiny in the cabinet of someone saying, hold on a minute, some experts are pointing out, and there's no statistical evidence these people are wrong, that 9 out of 10 of the positive cases we are identifying may actually be false, and we're basing an entire policy on false data?
Yeah, I don't think I don't think that's correct. I don't think we're basing our entire policy on false data, as you've suggested there. I'm slightly confused by your figures, but I'm going to go away and check them because you also said that Matt Hancock said it's probably 1%.
This is my policy. This is a policy that's being made by people who don't understand the statistics and the science. I've got your phone number. I will send you the document to explain to you what this false positive paradox is.
There, haven't you? You've said to me that Matt Hancock said it's 1 in 100. You've told me it's 9 out of 10.
They don't understand the statistics. These are functional idiots. I mean, this is embarrassing how bad this is. And Fauci should know better. The CDC should know better. The governors and their health committee should know better. First off, it's not 2.3%. It's very high. And I have all the statistics of this. I'm bringing out an article tomorrow for scientific publication showing you just how inaccurate the studies are. In some cases, you can have a positive or negative result, and it means nothing because they could be testing just a particle, a single tiny particle of virus that will do nothing in your body that you may have had for decades because there's no way of comparing the COVID-19 with any test with an earlier or multiple other COVIDs. Everything they've done about this is wrong. In any case, that is something you need to know because there's going to be more on that. Now, I want you to hear this. This is Dr. Schoening, S-C-H-O-N-I-N-G. He's a highly qualified medical doctor and also has an academic background in teaching. And he has an outstanding reputation. He's representing over 1,000 medical doctors by being there, who are in his group. 1,000 doctors, a lot of doctors, who say we've gotten it wrong. And instead of allowing him an opportunity to speak, he was arrested without committing any crime whatsoever. That's what's happening. Let's hear it.
My name is Heike Schöning. I'm a medical doctor from Germany, and I'm one of the founders of Doctors for the Truth, Ärzte für Aufklärung, and plus I'm a co-founder of their extra-parliamentary inquiry committee on COVID-19. So this is an association of more than 1,000 medical doctors around the world, and together we are saying the measures of the government regarding COVID-19 are absolutely inappropriate.
Were you, I'm so interested to meet you, somebody suggested you said you were going to be here. Germany's reaction and the protest in Berlin, apparently there were 850,000 people there, is that right? Is it? What's the situation like in Germany right now in terms of public opinion?
Well, I think it's more or less it's the same like in Britain, because the mass media and the government, they dominated, of course, the scene. But, we have a very strong peace movement in Germany. And, well, as you know, we had this experience in the 1930s and the 1940s. So a lot of people are aware of these things, what's going on, when the stories that are told by the governments and by the oligarchs are just not true. And we as medical doctors, we see that, well, we have no medical pandemic. Yeah, that's a good message, that we do not see any killer virus. And this is the plain data that shows us. So we need to stand up.
I spoke to a Harvard professor yesterday on my channel, Martin Kulldorff. He believes in age strategy. So you shelter the vulnerable is the best strategy, he says. Epidemiologists all over the world agree with him, but it's not happening. Why? Age-targeted strategy. Why is the age-targeted strategy not happening, even though top virologists like Professor Sunetra Gupta, Professor Carl Hennigan, professor I spoke to yesterday, why are we not following that age-targeted strategy when it comes to lockdowns?
Well, this is a good question, and this addresses a common sense. Because if we see a new virus, which could be deadly, then you could address to these to the target groups, but this didn't happen. And in fact, it was like this, and it's all over the world the same, that the risk groups are above 80 years in the average, plus they have one or several severe diseases. So there is none. There is a very, very small number who died of these SARS virus CoV-2 only.
So here's a doctor, and he was telling the truth. You have to help those who have comorbidities. By the way, obesity is a comorbidity, or heart disease, and those people should be given the traditional or alternative, depending upon your perspective, treatments. But people were kept from going to hospitals, and hence they died from the diseases they had and would have died in any case, but probably died sooner, because if you have cancer, you have heart disease, you have emphysema, and you're afraid to go to a hospital because you're afraid that you'll be infected with COVID-19 and then die, you're going to die from the disease you have because you're not getting medical treatment. And that was specifically the case for the spike in Sweden, where they just made a decision, we'll keep all the hospital and ICU rooms available for the young people. Well, of course, the young people never came, so they had empty hospital, empty ICUs, but big spike in people dying because they were old, not getting the treatment. Also, we were lied to. If you took all the people that they knew died in nursing homes, and by the way, right now, there is a lawsuit against one nursing home owner in New York State where 70 people died. And then if we took all the people who died, who were in nursing homes, assisted living centers, hospice cares, we'd be dealing with about 55% of the people, minimally. In fact, the CDC's own website 3 weeks ago showed that only 9% of people have actually can be shown to have died of COVID. And now Ireland, as you heard, and you're going to hear more tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, when they corrected for what the actual cause of death was, and when this Professor Cahill was very powerful in England, or in Ireland, when she said, and she She warned them. She said, as a coroner or medical doctor, if you falsify a death certificate, you'll lose your huge outpouring. Well, my dad died of Alzheimer's, and my father died of a stroke, and my mother died of cancer. Yet they were all listed as COVID. Those have all been corrected. So now they're correcting them. Italy's doing the same thing. So we have been conflating, meaning bringing together two completely opposite points of view. One is a person who has the COVID virus tests positive but does not die from it, like young people, or even get sick in most cases, and those where the COVID virus could exacerbate their death if they are over the age of 80 and have multiple comorbidities, which most do. But even if you're older and you're healthy, it's shown that you still are far, far less likely to develop the COVID, and if you do, to overcome it. So when you start factoring in all these discrepancies in the fact that we don't need a vaccine, there is no need for a vaccine because we have effective, inexpensive, and safe treatments right now. Five of them within medicine. They're old. They've been around a long time. And yet there is an active campaign to suppress them. Why? And it's because, in my opinion, because the profit motive. And I'm going to do a whole commentary tomorrow about looking at what we did wrong in the war on AIDS because of Anthony Fauci and Robert Gallo and a small group of people who controlled it, and the mistakes they made, the amount of lives it cost, and the fact that they wouldn't allow any other voices. If you were dissident, you were destroyed. Well, I happen to have 3,000 dissidents who've sent information, and I'm talking about top people from Harvard, George Washington University, Johns Hopkins University. I'm talking about chairmen of the department, Nobel Prize winners, who were against what was going on with AIDS. They were right. Fauci was wrong. The same Fauci today is stopping dissent, and the mainstream media is acting as the deplatforming people, along with Google and Facebook, etc. So when I tell you you've been had, you've been played, and for political and economic reasons, pay attention. Now, before we go to our guest, I want to play this clip from Martin Luther King because I advocate, as all of you know, because I've been doing demonstrations, leading efforts for so many things, to ban DDT way back in 1967, following the great work of Rachel Carson, the first environmentalist, working with Ralph Nader's group and many other groups to demonstrate against aldrin heptachlor, being the voice, the only voice on radio, 100 programs of Paul Rudershan, for all the Vietnam vets who are suffering from post-traumatic stress and exposure to Agent Orange dioxin until they finally get some relief. So I'm used to this. Never had a violent demonstration. Don't believe in it. Here's Martin Luther King and his rationalization for it.
What I'm saying is this. I would like for all of us to believe in nonviolence, but I'm here to say tonight that if every Negro in the United States turns against nonviolence, I'm going to stand up as a lone voice and say this is the wrong way.
I will never change in my basic idea that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to the Negro in his struggle for freedom and justice. I think for the Negro to turn to violence would be both impractical and immoral.
There is an increasingly vocal minority who disagreed totally with your tactics, Dr. King.
There's no doubt about that. I will agree that there is a group in the Negro community advocating violence now. I happen to feel that this group represents a numerical minority. Surveys have revealed this. The vast majority of Negroes still feel that the best way to deal with the dilemma that we face in this country is through nonviolent resistance. And I don't think this vocal group will be able to make a real dent in the Negro community in terms of swaying 22 million Negroes to this particular point of view. And I contend that the cry of black power is at bottom a reaction to the reluctance of white power to make the kind of changes necessary to make justice a reality for the Negro. I think we've got to see that a riot... is...
Okay, that was September 27th, 1966. Tomorrow I'll talk about how much advancement has occurred because of his suffering and others, many others, and how we had a quantum change. But it was done through several different pieces of legislation that the average American supported and had supported. So we'll deal with that, the story that's not being told. I'm going to save the five young men repeatedly disturbing an elderly veteran's meal for tomorrow. It's very powerful, in a good way, in a good way. And also, we're going to hear from Morgan Freeman tomorrow. I think you'll find it of interest. But right now, we're going to finish off our program by saying hello to Michael Caine. I gave you his background at the beginning of the program. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Michael, 6 months before the COVID pandemic, New York teachers had already drafted a petition against enforced vaccine mandates for educators. So given Governor Cuomo's support of state vaccine mandates and certain legislators eager to expand them, how much of a threat is it to teachers who will be forced to be vaccinated or could lose their jobs? And second, the president of the American Federation of Teachers supports that all teachers should be vaccinated against COVID when a vaccine comes to market in order to keep their jobs. So please summarize the challenge that you and about 4,000 other teachers who signed a petition face, and especially in light of the fact that now we can show that a teacher could take hydroxychloroquine combination with zinc and one of two antibiotics and be protected, and that would not necessitate any vaccine. That's not even being discussed. The form is yours.
Well, thank you. As you mentioned, Randy Weingarten, that's the president of the American Federation of Teachers. That's the national umbrella group that my union, the UFT, in New York City is under. She has recently said that she supports the mandatory vaccination of any in-person teacher with a vaccine that does not exist yet, the COVID vaccine. And there's a number of things that are a concern with this. One, this isn't even coming from lawmakers or scientists. Right now, we're dealing with a fight within our own union. I've been a unionist for 13 years. You know, my father's a bricklayer. My mother worked for the Postal Service. Lots of teachers in my family. I'm a progressive unionist. I am 100% opposed to anyone in my union or politician requiring a medical procedure for me or any other teacher to perform our job. And as you said, there's treatments and other things out there that can be done that make a vaccine not necessary. But I do want to say we completely support anybody, especially teachers, having easy and quick access to a COVID vaccine if that's what their choice is. I firmly and completely support anyone's choice to do that if they think that is the best way to do this. But I'm going to tell you some people that are unsure about this. Dr. Paul Offit, the inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, who's made millions of dollars off of the rotavirus vaccine and who is a staunch vaccine supporter, when he was asked if he'd take the COVID vaccine, he said, sight unseen, no. What am I taking? We have over 100 vaccines in experimental trials being warp speed, sped up to come to market, bypassing any and the majority of the safety and efficacy standards that are normally in place. And they want to force this on teachers in order to work in person. This is an experimental treatment. By any measure, this is experimental. It is coming way too fast. Vaccines take 5, 10, 20, 30 years in development, safety, and efficacy, and to see the post-market data on what's going on as well. So we have none of that now. So I want to encourage people to go to nyteachersforchoice.org. That's all one word, no numbers, all letters, nyteachersforchoice.org. All the information is there, and right at the top is a link to our petition. Any American can sign the petition, which is against forced vaccine mandates for educators and teachers. But I especially encourage union members, teachers, paraprofessionals, nurses, counselors, sanitation workers, firemen, policemen, food workers, trade unionists, please go to nyteachersforchoice.org and support this petition and get it out there. Because, listen, they're not going to stop with the teachers. They're going to come after the nurses, of course. Then they're going to say sanitation workers are at risk. Then they're going to say policemen are at risk. And it's not based on the sound science. It's really based on a profit motive.
Michael, both New York and the teachers' union have mandated random COVID testing for teachers and students. We know the problems with these tests already for determining any kind of a reliable benchmark for the spread of the virus and infectious rates. However, there seems to be a darker side to this effort that concerns a biotech company called Fulgent Genetics. Can you explain this, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So the UFT, which is the New York City Teachers Union, negotiated a reopening contract with New York City that requires mandatory random testing starting October 1st in city schools of teachers and students. So parents, pay attention to this, too. If you're randomly selected, they'll test you. Now, I asked my union if my DNA, my rights to my own DNA have been protected in this agreement, and they were unable to answer that. So me and New York Teachers for Choice sent them an email to Mike Mulgrew, our president, to all of the board members, all the vice presidents, and to health and safety of the UFT, saying, hey, we're not necessarily opposed to taking the test, but did you protect our rights to our DNA? Why am I concerned about this? Fulgent Genetics owns a proprietary genetic catalog. Now, that means they keep DNA on file for all types of uses. And who even knows in 5, 10, or 20 years what the value of DNA and a catalog like that is going to be? I've reached out now to city council people. I've talked to some reporters. I still have no answer. So regardless of the efficacy of the test, right, we know there's problems there. But I'm willing to take the test if they believe this is going to be a way to keep schools safe. But is my DNA safe? Do I still own the rights to my DNA? Everyone's dead quiet. I mean, like I said, Gary, I'm a progressive unionist. I support my union. I've been a union delegate before. I've gone to Albany lobbying for the UFT. I really appreciate the protections that the UFT has given me as a teacher. But why now is my union saying they want to force vaccinate me and they won't tell me if my DNA has been sold off in some deal, in a testing deal? It's very disturbing. Again, if you go to our website, nyteachersforchoice.org, we have articles and open letters there about this.
I would suggest, Michael, that you go to prn.fm and download the articles we've written, Richard Gale and myself, on COVID, the natural approaches to keep your immune system strong, but also the drugs that are safe and effective and inexpensive that would prevent someone from needing a vaccine. And also now there is a watershed of information coming out showing that the tests were wrong. They're not a gold standard. But also once they test you and you get a false positive, they could then say that because you're positive, you must have the vaccine. Now you have no choice. And they're going to put an experimental vaccine in you that already has some very questionable ideas about the nanoparticulate matter they're putting in your body, that it would be there forever and that it's never been this kind of vaccination in world history. I would not want someone to get vaccinated unless they had a full understanding of the science behind their lack of science and lack of safety behind this. And I just feel that you shouldn't allow anyone to rule over something as important as your life, especially when we know that the children are not vulnerable in this case, and that the teachers, unless they're older, around 70 to 80, they're not going to be vulnerable. And everything's been overplayed. Everybody has gotten this scared to death message, and no one's looking at the reality. And I think it's time to give the good information, the good video clips, the good documentaries that are out there to the teachers and the teachers' union so they know that this shouldn't be just another political issue. Michael, thank you very much for being on. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Michael Kane is here on behalf of New York Teachers for Choice.org. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you very much for listening and have a nice day.